Hi there, my name is Megan and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Richard gave me a list of things I'm supposed to say, of course, which he did want me to say hello to everybody and told me how warm and wonderful everyone is down here, so I really am pleased to be here. He also is, some of you may know that Richard is an AA trustee and is very, very involved in service work in AA and is a keeper of traditions. And so in accordance with that, I will do what I've been taught to do from the beginning, which is to tell just my story, what happened and, it's that little part about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. Oh, yeah. I don't have any of those wonderful excuses that a lot of people have when they get up here and they say that they were, you know, born into horrible, alcoholic, violent homes or anything like that. I wasn't. It's not that alcoholism doesn't run in my family, but looking in from the outside and even living through it, there isn't any real indication that that's what would happen to any of us. You have to understand, I didn't say this for years, so it's it's hard for me to acknowledge this, but I was born and raised in Beverly Hills. 90210 is the zip code of my birth. So it's not like I suffered as a kid. And my parents, were my father. I grew up in the 50s, and so my parents were typical 50s parents. My father went off to work every day, worked as a doctor in a hospital, worked too many hours. My mother took care of the household. They weren't particularly, demonstrative or emotional. Between the two of them and a couple of marriages each, they had 5 children. Although, when I was first sober, I always forgot to mention that, so people thought I was an only child. Like, how self-centered can that be? But we grew up, at least I grew up, I won't speak for them, everybody has their own story, but I grew up very well cared for. Alcohol was a normal part of living, but it wasn't cause for a scene, necessarily. Although, we found, looking through stuff in my parents' house over the couple weekends ago, and we found these pictures. My younger brother and I were just hysterical. My father looked so sheepish. We're opening up these old albums that we found in a trunk, and there's a picture of my mother on the floor with a drink in her hand, wearing nothing but a black slip, surrounded by people. And another picture of my father sitting on the couch with my Aunt Sally, similarly dressed in nothing more than a black slip, with a drink in her hand, in his lap. So I guess they had a good time. But we learned how to drink. I don't remember my first drink. We grew up with it always around us. There was wine at dinner every night. I had to learn from, I suffered so much. I had to learn what different types of wines were and what they went with and what they tasted like and what was appropriate. And so I did that very well. Majored in that. Also, my father was, because he was a physician, there was sort of an understanding that better living through chemistry was always possible. So I was taking drugs before I knew what they were because we traveled, the family traveled every summer to a place that was a 7-hour drive across the Mojave Desert away. So my mother would load us all in the back of the station wagon at 3 o'clock in the morning so we wouldn't hit the desert heat. And she would pop 2 Dexedrine and take a pack of cigarettes and give us a bunch of Compazine and hope that we slept through the desert. And then we'd finally get to our destination and we'd all take Miltown so she could get a good nap. So, there weren't very many scenes in my childhood of sort of drunken stupors. There were a couple of little mistakes where I drank too much. And did a few bad things in the back of somebody's car. But it wasn't really motivating my life. I was sort of drawn while I was still in high school to a seamier side of life just because it wasn't part of the environment that I thought I was growing up in. I thought we were so straight and narrow. So I took up with a college boy when I was still in high school who was he was a senior when I took up with him, and so he was in graduate school by the time we broke up. And he lived with the son of a very prominent state senator in California, and they sold drugs, pornography, and grew dope. And so I learned special ways of curing marijuana so that it tasted good. Most of them are dead or in jail or left the country. So, but I was really lucky because I looked so innocent. And I had this other life. You know, already in high school I had this other life. I was head cheerleader at a girls' school. Just really silly. And I, you know, I was already preparing for my little debutante stuff. And so I had this one side of me that was just did all the right things. And then this other side that was hanging out with older boys that sold pornography. And so it would never have occurred to my parents, for example, that I was going to be a troublemaker. And one time my boyfriend and I were at a party, which actually unfortunately got the front page of the LA Times because they put MDA in the punch. And yeah, well, they put a lot of MDA in the punch. And and unfortunately, one woman in particular drank a little too much of that punch, and she didn't make it out of that party, which was the first indication to me that this really could have something other than just a little fun attached to it. She died and at the party. And when the police, who were, of course, checking everybody that were at the party, came and asked my mom, had heard that I'd been at the party, and my mother said, oh, no, she couldn't have been. She's a cheerleader. She was at practice. I think she really believed that, but not for long. I was very worried about what other people thought fairly early on, and I did want to be liked. And I had a group of friends in high school that were sort of on the margins that nobody else liked, but I also at the same time made sure that I maintained my connections to the sort of debutante crowd and the scholarship crowd and that sort of stuff, so that I wasn't eliminating any possibilities. And I was pretty chameleon-like about being who I should have been with each group. And I didn't realize that was a problem. I thought that was a talent. But eventually, I went away to college, and my best friend and I went to college together and room together, and before the first night that we laid down our heads and before we made our beds or unpacked our furniture, we went to the liquor store and stocked up for our dorm room so we would have enough. I got a gallon of scotch and she got a gallon of gin, and we got enough wine and beer to entertain whoever might want to come over. And from that day until the day I got sober sometime later, I drank or used drugs or both every single day, with the exception of 4 days that I tried to prove to someone that I wasn't really a drunk. And it took off just like that. Once I was out of that environment where I wasn't supposed to be drunk every night and where I could do anything I want, I was drunk every night, every single night. And it didn't seem odd to me that it just picked up like that, that I was going through, within a fairly short time, a half a bottle of scotch a day, drinking wine and smoking marijuana. And, of course, that was UC Santa Barbara, so at that point I was only doing very natural kinds of drugs. I didn't really hit the hard stuff. But we entertained. Cindy and I entertained a lot. She figured out that she was more interested in entertaining than going to school, so she actually left after 2 quarters, but I thought that I could do it all. And I've heard a lot of people get up at these podiums and talk about how they don't really understand what happened, but they managed to get straight A's all the way through college. Now, for those of you who are tired of hearing that, let me tell you that was not my story. Thank you. I majored in personal psychopharmacology, and I did really well in that. But everything else... I did a few things that were sort of interesting, and I was talking to someone else about how you recognize alcoholism, even in people who seem to be able to hide it very well. There was obviously an obsession with drugs and alcohol early on. That my very first psychology experience, you know, you have to take introductory psychology no matter what your major is, and you had to do an experiment. So, of course, mine involved alcohol. I did... I was only 18, the drinking age in California. I was 21. It didn't matter to me. I was going to turn in a paper that talked about getting my fellow students drunk and didn't realize there was anything wrong with that. And then the third quarter that I was there, I took a course in human sexuality and did... which actually, now that I think of that, is the only course in human sexuality I have, which I'd like you to remember because I'll get back to that. It's really silly now that I think of it. But we had to do some sort of paper or experiment or project for that. So my boyfriend and I at the time did a paper on alcohol and the angle. We got lots of volunteers. And the professor kept the paper. So I truly was obsessed. I switched colleges. I had to go someplace serious. Santa Barbara's not really a serious school, or was. I didn't see it that way at the time. So I went up to Berkeley. Where the drugs are much better. Found out a lot about drugs in Berkeley. And I was interested in chemistry. And I think, looking back on it, that my primary interest in chemistry stemmed from the fact that I learned how to make grain alcohol my first semester there and how to distill your own. And then there was a graduate student from Columbia in the lab that I worked in. And so we also learned how to get cocaine out of the bottles that looked like perfume bottles that his aunt was sending him from home. So, like I said, I studied really hard in my major of choice. Unfortunately, the dean didn't really recognize that. So I spent most of my time on probation. I skated out of there with like a 2-point average. I mean, just barely. and went home and went to work. And I took jobs that involved alcohol. I mean, what else would you do? I worked for a guy who sold pornography and drank a lot, but his front was that he was an insurance salesman. That was my first job. And eventually, I took a job as a secretary in a legal department in a title insurance firm that my great uncle had founded. And so I was, you know, I got the job on my own merits, but once... No, true. I can type. But once I got there and they figured out who I was, then I was sort of treated with kid gloves and asked to the kinds of special functions that secretaries don't get asked to. And there was a guy who... Because it was a title company, it was the home office of a title company that's around the world, and I worked in the legal department, and they often had lawyers come in from out of town to work on a case that was being taken care of in another state. So this guy from Oklahoma comes in, and I was still having a pretty good time at that point. I was having an affair with my boss. I was dating a bunch of other people. I didn't see anything weird about that, about any of that. My boss was married, of course. And so this guy shows up from Oklahoma, and I'm asked, he's the head of a big law firm in Oklahoma, so he's slightly higher echelon than we're used to welcoming in our little legal department. And I was supposed to help him go through the construction books, which is what I was basically in charge of. And then also, I was expected to entertain him. And I knew what that meant. I was sort of surprised that they would ask me to do that, but I had the company credit card, and so I entertained him. I took him to dinner, and then I went back to his hotel with him. I really, honest to God, thought that's what I was supposed to do, what they meant. Because I was drinking such an enormous amount, I don't think that I had any feelings associated with any of that behavior. I know that, like for many of us, I don't know if anybody in this room can relate to this actually, but that sex was kind of what I did. It was a way of feeling anything. And so I didn't think of it as something bad or evil. I thought of it as something really fun and entertaining and occasionally inconvenient. But so I, and this was a okie, you know. This was he apparently thought more of it than I did. But but I was drunk when we went back to his room and doing what I did, and I think I fell asleep at one point in the middle of something. And and when I woke up later in the middle of the night, I recognized that he looked different, and it took me a minute to recognize that he didn't have any hair, that he had had hair when we went out to dinner. He didn't have hair when I woke up in the middle of the night. And I was appalled at my reaction, because my first reaction was, oh, my God. And I thought, oh, no, you're not supposed to express this. You're not supposed to express how you feel, you know, God forbid. I was supposed to be understanding and nice, and so I was very on guard about how I expressed myself around this guy after that, and I took extra care just in case I had insulted him in any way by a stray look in the dark, which he wouldn't have got. I mean, he drank as much as I did that night, too. But whenever I saw him at the office, I was very nice to him, and he was in and out of town, and he was married, so I didn't think anything of it. And I mean, wouldn't get serious. And eventually I got another job, but he called me there and started sending flowers. And I thought, well, this is weird. Maybe he just wants a little out-of-town girl or something. We had his credit card, even if I didn't have my company, so it was still pretty fun. And it got kind of serious, and you say the kinds of things you always do to people that you sleep with a lot. And again, I didn't think... So one day, one Friday afternoon, like he normally did, he showed up at my office, and he had this enormous diamond ring, the kind of diamond rings you only see in this part of the country. And I felt guilty. I thought, well, I must have let him on in some way. I don't know. And he announced that he had gotten a divorce and that so that we could get married. And I thought, holy shit. So I didn't know what else to do but say yes. So, and it was my parents, to their credit, were very understanding of this and took it. I think I learned my sense of humor from them. Trust me, if you had to live with us kids, you had to have a sense of humor. But this was the most conservative. I mean, he's a dead ringer for Rush Limbaugh. Thank you very much. I was thinking the same. And very serious. Very serious, okay. And so my father, he wanted to ask for my hand in marriage. You can tell that I hadn't quite found my liberal bearings yet at this point. But my father, Michael was my ex-husband. Michael was very worried about what people thought, too. It made us a good couple. We were both very concerned about what other people thought. He was not a heavy drinker, as you define them down here. just a drinker. And he bought himself a new tux, and he bought me a new dress. And rented a big Cadillac so he could go over to my parents' house, pick them up, and take them out to the best restaurant in Los Angeles, where he would ask for my hand in marriage. And my parents knew this was coming, and I was sort of asking to please be tolerant. They'd put up with Jamaican taxi drivers. They could deal with this. And so my father met us at the door wearing a full-length caftan, wearing black velvet Chinese embroidered slippers and carrying a purse. Now, is that a good excuse to start drinking that evening or what? And I was, it was, poor Michael, you know, we just didn't take it as seriously as he did. I got to Oklahoma after I got married, and actually before I got married, I came back and got married and went back to Oklahoma. And I became obsessed with the drinking laws in Oklahoma. I don't know how many of you know those drinking laws. It's bizarre that you can't. It's like a dry state, but if you buy this membership, then you own part of a bottle behind the bar, and you can have a drink. But you have to show your membership, and in spite of all this legality around whether or not you're allowed to drink, if you have one of those cards, they'll give you a drink to go. So it's okay. To walk out of a bar with a drink in your hand, get into the driver's seat, and drive off with it. But not okay to walk up to a bar without a card and order a drink. And so, of course, my wallet in no time. And this was me in my respectable days, that he had a couple of ex-wives. I was only number three. There were many more after that. He had a daughter by his second marriage and a stepdaughter by his first marriage who was more attached to him than to her father. And she ended up, the older daughter from his first marriage, wasn't really his daughter, ended up living with us, and he eventually adopted her, and actually they work together now. But so here I was, 23 years old, newly married, a total alcoholic with no idea of what it is, with a 16-year-old girl in my household to whom I'm supposed to be the stepmother. We actually went out and got our new cars on the same day. Oh, God, this is coming back. And she got, you know, she's a good, okay, she got a Cutlass, a two-door Cutlass, and I got a 10th anniversary edition Trans Am with a T-top and a gold eagle on top. You can tell what kind of adult influence I was on her life. They didn't have cell phones then, and so, you know, I had to drive all over Hell's Half Acre because that's how big it was. And so they wanted to make sure, since I wasn't used to weather, that I could get in touch with somebody. Well, you know, if you're from L.A., there is no weather. There's weather in Oklahoma. And they got me a CB radio, so I was tooling up and down the highway with a fat wallet drink in my hand and the handle of Lady Bandit. And Michael was a respectable, is very much a respectable kind of guy. And I was trying very hard to live up to what I thought his wife should be. He was the senior partner in what at that time was the largest oil and gas law firm in Oklahoma. I knew that I was supposed to be entertaining, that I was supposed to look good on his arm. He told me that. I actually was very proud of myself. When I first moved to Oklahoma, I went out and got a job, similar to the kind of job I had held in California. And when I came back and told him about it, he looked at me like I was crazy and said that no wife of his could work, because how would that look? So I didn't work, because he didn't want me to. Didn't matter that he was broke with all this alimony he was paying. But but I couldn't work. And so I didn't know what else to do, so I went to school. Which was, again, not something I had been very good at. But anyway, I was driving back and forth to Norman, Oklahoma, from the north side of Oklahoma City every day. And I had a completely different life at school than I had at home. At school, I had people my own age who kind of hung out and didn't quite know what to do with themselves and felt kind of a lot like I did. We were involved in some very serious research, which I think is pretty funny considering that I was pretty far gone most of the time, but I was lucky enough, I can't believe all the privileges I've had, that when the chemistry lab that I worked in Berkeley was the lab of a Nobel Prize winning chemist, and I got to work on one of the shuttle mission experiments while I was drunk and loaded. And when I was, aren't y'all glad? I wasn't responsible for any of the engineering. And when I was in Oklahoma, I got to work with Washoe, who is a chimp who was known for speaking sign language. And really was incredibly fortunate to have those opportunities, which, of course, I didn't take advantage of. You would think I would know better, but I didn't. Mostly I just hung out, drank, and had a good time. And then I would go back to my husband's house. I never really thought of it as my house. And I would have to get dressed up and go out to dinner with his partner and his clients and entertain them. And over the period of time that I was living in Oklahoma and drinking and worrying, I was only there for 2 years. I lost, I don't know, 30 pounds. I left there at about 104 pounds. and pretty sick, drinking almost all the time. My drug use was held back at that point because he was, you know, a respectable boy. And so I didn't do drugs. I smoked 3 packs a day and was drinking. And actually, I say that, I took prescription drugs because the psychiatrist, when I went to complain that I wasn't quite feeling right, the psychiatrist put me on heavy-duty tranquilizers, Sinequan. So I was taking Sinequan and drinking a quart of scotch a day, smoking 3 packs of cigarettes. And, you know, I wasn't feeling very good. And So I assumed that it had to do with him, that it was his fault, and his stepdaughter's fault, and Oklahoma's fault, and, you know, it wasn't right. So I announced that I was getting a divorce and leaving, and I was so cruel. You know, I just decided that that was the problem, and I took the action. So I just left. He said, "Don't you want to try and go to marriage counseling?" I said, "Nah, it won't work." And called in my best friend, and we packed my stuff and took my car and went back to L.A. And when I got around to making amends years later, he never spoke to me directly, but his stepdaughter, by then his daughter, did. And, you know, the havoc we wreck in other people's lives, that apparently was about a year before he really was able to sort of comprehend what had hit him, which, of course, didn't stop him from getting married several times after that, so it's I didn't bust his chances altogether. But that started to be a theme for me. I got back to L.A., and I was working off and on, mostly as a secretary, and I dated a lot of guys, and I started going to church, a little church in Santa Monica, and I really wasn't clicking with any of these boys. And I was joining a bunch of church committees with all these interesting women, and and, you know, I suddenly realized, looking around the room, that none of those women were married, and none of them had a boyfriend. And in fact, these were adult, older women who lived with each other. I'm really slow. And eventually I caught on, though. And I thought, that must be the problem. It must be guys. If I were just a lesbian, it would work. I would be a happy girl. And God forbid I should let them know that I had any hesitation about this at all. So I made up this incredibly elaborate story about my past life as a lesbian. And and started spreading it around, and then started dating them. And, you know, I did with them exactly what I had done with all those boys. I went out to dinner and took them home. I wasn't any different. And, you know, some of them were not very happy with that, because I didn't let them come with their U-Haul. Just because I didn't understand at that point, not because of any virtue on my part. And finally, you know, I did allow myself to be seduced by a doctor, who was actually also the priest's girlfriend. So so I got kicked out of church, but I got myself a doctor. And and she, you know, because she was, you know, at least, you know, when I do my seducing, I do the best. She was head of the largest OBGYN practice west of the Mississippi. And so she had a ton of money. And so it wasn't that she didn't want me to work. By this time I was drinking pretty much all the time, and I didn't have to work, which was a good thing, because I'm not so sure by that time I really could have worked. I think by that time I'd given up secretarial work and was working retail, which I really loved, but it doesn't require a whole lot of thought to dress people up. And so she took me in, and I became her wife, which was what I had learned how to do. She didn't like to shop. Well, I knew how to shop, so so I went shopping and bought her clothes and brought them back, and what she didn't like I took back and went shopping for myself, and I hung out at the hospital when I didn't have anything else to do, which I work in a hospital now and I realize now how weird that is, but I didn't at the time. I thought, well, what else would you do? And we had this wonderful, she bought this wonderful house for us in Pacific Palisades, which is, I see lots of heads nodding, it's this wonderful community. We had a house on the cliffs overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Absolutely incredibly beautiful, breathtaking views from every window. And also because that wasn't enough for me, I liked mountains too. So she she indulged me and bought a little cabin in a community known as Idlewild, which is a mountain community just above Palm Springs, about 90 minutes door to door from one place to the other. And I did what you hear housewives do. I had accounts at 3 liquor stores in Pacific Palisades. I ordered from different ones. They delivered. I drank all day when I wasn't going to the hospital. When she came home, I did to her what I had done to my husband, which is lie through my teeth and say, oh, I was just pouring myself my first drink. Would you like one? And because my life became increasingly involved in sort of hiding those sides of me that I didn't want people to know, mostly the fact that I drank all the time, and the rest of the stuff I was involved in was just drinking and using prescription drugs. I'd given up, again, illegal drugs, because she was a doctor and I didn't want to embarrass her. So I'd had to give up the cocaine, but I was still doing amphetamines pretty steadily. And my social life, surprise, diminished, because I didn't know anyone in the way we come to think of knowing people here. I put on a show for people regularly, her friends and acquaintances, and the only person that I really kept in contact with was this one straight woman who had been sort of a friend of a friend that I had met through this group of church people, and who remained friends with me even after I got kicked out of the church. And she lived, Los Angeles is like Houston, it's a big place, and people live miles away from each other, and it's nothing to think of driving an hour to go see somebody. And she lived about an hour's drive away in the middle of town in this cute little apartment that didn't have a washer and dryer. I lived in this big mansion overlooking the ocean, and I had a washer and dryer. So she would call me and she'd say, I need to do my laundry. Can I come over? And I would say yes and think, oh, isn't this fun? I don't have to drive, because I couldn't. The only reason I never got a DUI is because when I knew it was a problem, that if I drank and drove, I'd get arrested, I quit driving. So she would drive all the way over with her laundry, and she would put it in, and she'd say, you know, I'm feeling a little antsy. I want to go to an AA meeting. And I'd say, okay. I don't get this, but all right. And then she'd say, well, you know, I don't live on this side of town, so would you go with me? So I went with her, and you know, she was a good friend, and I knew not to piss off the only person that I really had left in my life, so I didn't. I went with her when she asked me to, but it did upset me because it meant that I couldn't drink before I went. And I wasn't totally unfamiliar with AA. I forgot to mention that when I, my first year in college, when I was at Santa Barbara, that one of my older brothers who lived in Santa Barbara as well had been my dealer, had been really good about getting me drugs when my parents' medicine cabinet was empty. And about 4 or 5 months after I got there, he got sober, which, I mean, that's really bad when your dealer gets sober. And he took me to an AA meeting in Santa Barbara, and it was everything that you've heard from the outside that they are. It was in a church basement. I was the only woman at that meeting. All the men were in long trench coats. It was very dark. The speaker spoke from a stage like this, and above the stage, unlike this area up here, somebody had painted this mural of the 12 steps, and they were 12 sparkling steps against the navy blue background. Numbered, and at the top was, like, I don't remember exactly, but it was like a rainbow or angel's wings or something like this. And anyway, it looked pretty hokey to me. They all seemed really depressed, and I didn't ever want to go back. And that was my exposure to AA, sum total, before this woman started dragging me to AA meetings in Santa Monica so that she'd have some company. Of course, when I got there, what I thought was really weird, although it took me a while to register this, was that we would get to these meetings and she would know everybody. So, I had no idea why she was dragging me along, but I was already there, and the speakers were always amusing, and I thought it was so fun that people had someplace to go other than the bars. I, of course, hadn't been able to go to a bar in many years because, as I said, I'd given up drinking and driving. And so I was drinking at home by myself most of the time without anybody. Anyway, it was Thanksgiving in 1983, and my doctor, lover, and I, and her parents and our dog, the cutest little dog, we went to our little mountain retreat in Idlewild where it was cold, and we cooked dinner that day, and we went for a walk, and I was on very good terms with her parents, as good terms as I could be with anybody at that time in my life, but I thought they were generally pleased to have me around, and I was pleased that they were pleased. And really, if you had asked me at the age of 20 what I wanted in my life, I would have told you that scene, that I would have liked a rich doctor, a house at the beach, a house in the mountains, a sort of surrounded by loving family. It was perfect. It was exactly what I would have wanted. And yet, I still had those feelings, like I didn't have any friends, and I felt really lonely. I felt that when I was with people, most of the time I had to hide who I was or pretend to be someone I wasn't. I really, by that point, had been drinking so much and taking so many drugs that I was incapable of working. I mean, it was fine with her that I didn't work, and I had sort of slipped out of working over the years as I got drunker and drunker, but I was really incapable of working. And and that day, as on so many days, when I woke up in the morning before I put the turkey in, I poured myself a tall glass of scotch without ice, and that glass was full all day, not because I wasn't drinking. It stayed full all day, through the walks, through dinner, through football. And towards the end of the day, her parents went to bed in the bedroom, and I leaned over at the bar, a little kitchen bar, to get some more scotch, and I fell off the bar stool. And trust me, it was not the first time I'd fallen off a bar stool. It certainly wasn't the first time that I'd been drunk as a skunk or that I'd drunk all day. It wasn't the first time that I'd felt lonely or the first time that I felt empty. But it was the first time that it all sort of came together, and I got it. in one moment that there was something wrong with this picture, that I had everything I wanted and I felt like shit inside, so much so that I had to start drinking from the beginning of the day till I fell off a bar stool at the end of the day. And I have a brief memory of just a sane moment, right, asking God for help. And also of Karen, the doctor, coming to me and thinking that it, of course, good Al-Anon that she is, asking, thinking that that I meant her. And in that moment, I got it, that it wasn't about her. I wouldn't regain that level of clarity for some time again, but but I got it at that moment, that it wasn't about her, that it was about me and the alcohol, and that was it. And I didn't drink again that night, and I didn't drink the next day. And the next day after that, when we went back home to the Palisades, that morning I went to a meeting without my friend Pamela and identified myself as an alcoholic for me. And then it really gets funny. The women at my first meeting, this was a bunch of suburban housewives and straight housewives in the Palisades, and they were very concerned since it was my first meeting for me. They didn't want me to be around alcohol at all. It is it is something to listen to, and something that I heard early on, that you don't spend time when you're trying to get sober in the beginning. You don't spend time around booze. So you don't go to bars, which of course wasn't a problem for me. You don't, but you also don't hang out in places where you used to drink. And I drank at parties, and that night Karen and I were entertaining some of her colleagues, and of course I was going to serve booze, and they were horrified. I had to, it was okay for me to, I still think this is ridiculous. I could go home and I could cook dinner and I could set the table and I could greet them at the door, but then I had to leave. And I listened to them and I did what I had always done, which is sort of acknowledge and sort of agree in principle to go along with this, and then I didn't follow through. I lived through those first 3 months of sobriety by the skin of my teeth. It really was the grace of God. It had nothing to do with me. I didn't listen to what people said. I went to meetings. I probably went to 3 or 4 a week. I didn't drink. I smoked like a chimney. I talked to my friend Pamela, who became my sponsor, and kind of survived. I went through, because I had drunk so much for so long, some of us developed some physical problems as a result. And I had a number of really bad physical consequences from alcohol. I couldn't, my gastrointestinal system was so shocked that I couldn't absorb nutrients. So I was once again, when I came into the program, 104 pounds. And it didn't matter what I ate or how much I ate. I couldn't keep food down. And I also couldn't sleep. That's not exactly a rare problem, but the sleeping, of course, I think as all of us do when we come in and we can't sleep, I thought it would kill me. And so they felt sorry for me, and one of Karen's partner's best friends was a hypnotherapist who practiced in San Francisco, and he was down visiting his friend, the doctor, and I'd sort of been complaining about insomnia. They wanted to give me hypnotics. I didn't want to take any drugs. And so we were sort of going around and around. And they said, well, why don't you try this hypnotherapy thing? So I did. He came by the house, and he hypnotized me and gave me the tape. And it was a wonderful experience. I felt very relaxed. I was able to use it to go to sleep for many years until somebody stole the tape. And afterwards, we went down for a walk along the beach. And as we walked, he told me that he also was in AA. We probably spent maybe all together 2.5 hours together that day. His name was Floyd. And he We had a lovely, very serious conversation about getting sober and meditation and staying sober and spirituality, which, of course, I didn't understand at that point. But I was listening, and he sounded calm, and I appreciated it. And he let me sleep, which was important to me. When, and this was maybe a month into sobriety, I got sober on Thanksgiving Day of 1983, so it was December, early January. And I can't remember what we did. The sequence is getting a little faded here, but we went on a trip, a bunch of girls, Karen and me and some friends, and there were two other couples that went, and three of them boated, and three of us didn't do boats. So they took a boat down to Mexico, and the three of us flew. And, you know, got in all sorts of trouble with driving across Mexico, and it was very fun. Karen was slightly different when she met us there, and then when we got back, they took the boat back, and the three of us flew back. When we got back in March of that year, she let me know that she had been having an affair with the woman who owned the boat, and that she wanted me gone. And I, of course, I was furious. She couldn't leave me. I loved her. I actually didn't know anything else. I was desperate. You know, I hadn't worked in a long time. I'd become accustomed to a certain way of living. But I don't think I was in touch with all that. I really did feel sort of appalled and afraid, and went for a long walk to think about this. And, you know, she's fast. She didn't get to be the biggest doctor that she is because she's stupid. By the time I got back to the house, the checking account had been cleared out. And I had the clothes on my back, the car she gave me, and $5,000, which she gave me, and I hadn't worked a real job in years, and I was sick as a dog. So I asked my sponsor if I could stay with her for just a couple of days. I was there for 4.5 months, sleeping on this futon chair on her living room in a part of town that when I was a kid, my parents would drive me there to visit the housekeeper's family and know that I wasn't supposed to get out of the car. So, my sponsor, Pamela, was a straight woman and really didn't quite know what to do with me, and I wasn't really sure what I was. But she found a gay meeting, Sunny, one block away from where she lived, and it was actually a gay clubhouse, the AT Center in Los Angeles, if any of you have been. And they have meetings all the time. They have meetings at 6 and at noon and at 6 and at 8 and at midnight and, I don't know, all the time. They have meetings and they have this pot of coffee going all the time and cookies. So Pamela went to work and I went to the clubhouse. And I also was too embarrassed, of course, caring too much about what I look like, to ask for help. And I didn't really have any money. And so I lived on those cookies. And people were incredibly kind to me. They took me out to coffee and dinner and fed me and dragged me around. And I did what they said, and I didn't drink in between meetings. And I was devastated. They put up with me bawling at every single meeting. Oh, she left me. How could she do that? What am I going to do? And people were really good about it's something I didn't understand until fairly recently, but they would say, you know, that's fine. You know, just keep coming back and don't drink. And I think, how is this going to solve my problem? And I went, they took me to other meetings. I really hadn't been exposed to anything gay and lesbian really much before this. So I actually never been to a gay bar until I got sober. But I went to a couple of gay clubhouses, including the Alcoholism Center for Women, which at the time that I was getting sober was the only lesbian residential recovery house in the country. And it was in a really seedy part of town. And I show up in my little suburban outfit with my station wagon, and there are all these women in leather and tattoos, and I'm terrified. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know where I belong. And it, you know, at this point, I'm newly sober. I want to fit in, and I don't feel like I fit anywhere. I couldn't recognize, because of how things looked, that these people, first of all, that I looked as strange to them as they looked they looked to me, and secondly, that what they were being was accepting and loving and open, and they were following the traditions in AA, that it didn't matter how nuts I was, but the fact that I had a desire to stop drinking and to stay sober was enough, and they were incredibly kind to me. Of course, I didn't interpret it that way, having always depended on the kindness of strangers in the particular way that I did. I thought that every gesture of kindness was a come on. my gorgeous body. Which, as the only person in this room who's ever seen me newly sober will often remind me, when I was newly sober, I was same height I am now, 5'7". I weighed 104 pounds. I had sort of yellowish gray skin and purple hair that was spiked up like this. I was such a seductive sight, I'm sure. Oh, God. But, and I couldn't work. I mean, I couldn't. This comes out in every pitch that I make, but it's important for me to remember that my brain cells were so fried when I came in that I couldn't get a full-time job as a receptionist, because when I held the phone and asked you for your name and number and who it was for, I couldn't do the three things at once that were required: to listen, to write, and to process the information and pick it up and remember who it was. I mean, I couldn't do that. It was much too difficult for me. And I was sure that I would never be able to do anything again. That I was going to... I took heart from Clancy, who's, I'm sure a lot of you have heard, or his tapes, or him personally, always tells a story about telling people who come in and complain that they can't get a job because they have bad teeth. He says, well, then get a job that doesn't require teeth. And I was lucky enough to be able to hear that. So I went out and got a temp job, a series of hysterical temp jobs. It was really, I mean, at the time I didn't think they were fun, but in retrospect, of course, they're very fun. My first temp job was working as a statistical typist for one of those sort of money laundering companies that supports the rag trade, where they charge ridiculously high interest rates to some poor family trying to make a living selling clothes wholesale. But I didn't know what it was. I just knew that if you put me in front of a typewriter with a bunch of numbers, that I could type them in all day and not screw up. And I also had a job as, somebody told me what this was called. There's a name for this that I didn't hear until years after I'd left the job. But I was, I'm not Jewish in spite of my background, but I got a job at a girls yeshiva high school in Beverly Hills. And the reason they like to hire people like me is that on Fridays during the winter, I could work until the end of the day. And the rest of them had to go home, because the sun goes down and it's Friday. It's Shabbat. So, and I would have these ridiculous arguments with the... It was during my first year in sobriety, because I was dating this guy. I couldn't make up my mind. I was dating... I did not follow that rule. Or as my significant other pointed out to me last night, what I did was follow the rule to the letter, that I didn't change anything significant about my lifestyle when I came into the program. I continued doing exactly what I had done before. But they were all sober. So... So one guy that I was dating during this period of time was a fallen Jew, and he would come to pick me up at the yeshiva, and the rabbi would make him put his yarmulke on, chide him about not coming back into the fold, and what was he doing dating this goyim? So, I worked. I came to work, and work became something that I could do. And I knew that I would never be able to do anything spectacular, but I knew I could work and eventually come to support myself through my own contributions. And that was a novel concept for me, trust me. It was never something I had planned. So I did it a little ass backwards after I got that under the way. I started doing the steps of the program. I really, as I say, it really was a miracle that I managed to stay sober in the beginning. I did what I was told. I certainly did everything that I was told to do that first year. And one of the things in Los Angeles that you learn very early on is the idea of service, that you provide service not only to your immediate group by washing out coffee cups and ashtrays, which I guess they don't do anymore, but making coffee, and in Los Angeles, making food. Food is a big deal in Los Angeles. Every meeting outdoes the others with food. And it kept me sober. I was signed up. God forbid I should do anything myself. I was signed up to be on the food committee for Hollywood Squares, which is the big Saturday night Hollywood gay meeting with a couple hundred people every Saturday night. And the meeting was at 8:30, and we got there at 5. And we would all trace off with this guy who'd been doing the food for years. He would throw us in the back of his big car, and we would go to the market and buy humongous chunks of cheese and, you know, super packages of bologna and ham. And we had, you know, this is gay boys meeting, and so they had lots of doilies, and and we spent hours, I mean literally hours, cutting up cheese and bologna and arranging them in gorgeous patterns on these doilies. But the important part is that while we did that, those of us who were new got to listen to people who had lots of time, who were also very involved in service, talk about what it was like for them and what they did each day in the face of, you know, life, what they did each day to stay sober. And it also kept me, at a time of day that I would normally be having a cocktail, it kept me involved in something about sobriety. And in Los Angeles, we also had, in addition to the stuff that everybody has in all over the country about GSRs and representatives, we also had this great meeting once a month at a place, at a big church in the center of town, where you could go and sign up to be part of a group that went to bring meetings into different kinds of institutions. So I got to go to the Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Norwalk. Places that a girl from Beverly Hills really had never thought she'd go before. I went to the county jail. I went to women's shelters downtown and brought AA to communities that might not otherwise have it. And I don't know what good I did for them. I brought cigarettes. That was my contribution, and told what little story I had at the time to tell. But they did a lot for me, a lot, to show, again, it was the thing of hanging out with people who had more time than I did on those long drives from downtown to Norwalk, and listening to how they stayed sober, recognizing that AA was this much larger community than me and my little gay group that I went to. And I also, in Los Angeles, when you have 6 months of sobriety, you're allowed to answer the phones at central office only between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. They leave the day shifts for people who have time. And so, again, you signed up for this thing, and you would sort of take responsibility for a shift. So it would be my responsibility, since I had signed up for one of these shifts, to find somebody else to come with me, bring sleeping bags, and we would sleep on the floor, eat junk food, and answer the phone all night, and listen to people. At that, I guess the thing is that when you're newly sober, to have to listen to people all night long who are really in the depths of their disease reminds you that you really don't want to drink today. So it, you know, I got a couple people probably to a meeting and hooked some old timers up with some people who expressed a desire to stay sober, and I stayed sober because of that service work, which was vitally important to my sobriety. I did. I worked the steps as well. I was going to say as they're written, but that's not entirely true. When I did the fourth step, you know, it was much more complicated than it was in the book. So, so my sponsor at the time heaved yet another big sigh and handed me the Hazleton booklet for how to do a four-step. So I did it that way. And I did it, and I talked to her about it. I was relieved to tell. I mean, I have, I suppose, some secrets that, I guess I don't have any more from that period of time. I have no more secrets from that period of time that only she knows. but it was such a relief to, like, tell someone all these deep, dark, awful things about me and not have her throw me out of the room. In fact, she actually insulted me a bit because she giggled and thought that that was pretty funny. And here I'd been living with this angst for years and she's laughing. Don't take yourself so seriously. That was the message she gave me. Anyway, I did the steps of the program. I made, when I got to the part about taking the fourth step and turning it into the eighth step and then going and making amends, I had extorted a bunch of money from one of my former employers, and when I went, you know, I was still doing temp jobs. When I went to make amends and to make payment arrangements, he hired me back. And that was pretty phenomenal, actually. It was one of those remarkable things, because what happened was that I got to do my old job that had involved drinking a lot in a completely different way. And it was unfortunate, however, that when I'd been drinking with him before, I had introduced him to cocaine, and eventually that became his downfall. But in the meantime, he was very generous with me and with sort of allowing me to find my way in the world as a newly sober person. And I would go to this Monday evening beginners meeting every week. And we had, in Los Angeles, we had podiums like this. And, you, I mean, it's L.A., right? You got to stand up and talk at a mic. And these three women, one of them was a bus driver, and one of them was, she worked in, like, factory-type work. And another one was, like me, sort of had a lifetime of being a temporary secretary and receptionist, and they were going to college, and they stood up, middle-aged women going to college, and they stood up every Monday and talked about the woe of being in college and having to make lumpy pots for the required art class, and how, and they wept every Monday. They wept, but they didn't drink, and they stayed in school. And I was, oh, I forgot that story. I need to tell you just one little thing that happened early on in sobriety at that moment that my lover left me. Because people say, See, this is so bizarre. I forget that I have miracles happen to me. I'm the one, after I tell you the story, you won't believe this, but I'm forever the one who's standing there saying, well, nobody ever burns any bushes for me. Bill Wilson can get it, but why can't I? And what happened to me that day that Karen left and the bank account was cleared out is that at that moment, when I got back to the house and figured out what was going on, I wanted to die. You know, I didn't know what I would do. I knew I couldn't work. I knew I couldn't take care of myself. I knew without someone supporting me every step of the way, I couldn't stay sober. Without a person, get this, not God, but without a person, I couldn't stay sober. And so I was ready to kill myself. And because she was still entertaining and she was a doctor, we had a ton of alcohol and drugs in the house at that time. And I was... I didn't want to make a mess. I really cared what people thought. And I didn't want to... I also didn't want to screw up. I wanted to make sure that if I was going to kill myself, I was going to kill myself, that there wouldn't be any of this rushing off to the hospital to revive me and pump my stomach, which I hadn't done before, but I heard was really disgusting from a lot of friends who had it done. And so I had gathered all the booze up into the master bath and was pulling the pills out of the drawers and lining them up in such a way that I knew that I could still manage to drink this down without passing out from the pills and all this stuff, and the phone rang. And I don't know. I don't know why I picked up that phone. I mean, I was not the type to answer. I was the type that had one of the... I was a screener, you know. I never answered my phone. But I picked it up that day. And it was that guy, Floyd, who I had spent a total of 2.5 hours with, who lived in San Francisco. And he said to me at that moment, without even saying hello, he said, you know, I was doing my morning meditation this morning, and you came up really strong. And I don't know what's going on for you right now, but whatever it is, I think you should stop what you're doing and get on the next plane and come up and spend a weekend with us. Okay. The funny thing about that is that he was spending a weekend at a nudist colony in Marin, which is also a part of my early sobriety. Anyway. So these girls got up and they talked about going to school. And so eventually I decided that the one with no brain cells would go and take a class. So I took a class. And I had learned how to do things in AA. I had learned to show up. I had learned to follow direction. I had learned to be thorough. I had learned to follow through. All of those things I had learned in AA. And I was the one who thought that that part of the 12th step where it says, you know, we practice these principles in all our affairs, you can imagine what I used to think that was for. But slowly I got it and applied it to all the areas of my life, and so I took this class and I did well. And I took another one. And then I took some more. And my boss at the time was generous enough to let me leave early so that I could get to class, and then eventually all sorts of things happened, and I went to work for the college, and then I quit working for the college so I could go to school full time, and you can see where this is going. And, you know, unlike that person years before who had gotten a 2.0 and been on the dean's list for the wrong reasons, the probation list part of the dean's list more, I was on the other dean's list now, and somebody asked me where I was going to apply to graduate school, and really, no brain cells, I laughed. And she hounded me, this professor, and so finally I applied to grad school just to show her that I couldn't get in, and of course, I got in. And so I moved to Philadelphia to go to grad school, and in the program that I'm in, you have a competitive internship that you have to apply for, and I applied all over the country, and unfortunately the woman who had been my mentor and gotten me into grad school had died, but she had gone of cancer. She had gone to University of Chicago, so on a whim, just sort of to honor her, thinking they're never going to pick this gutter drunk, middle-aged woman with a really bad academic history. I applied there. Also, I was applying to other places in Chicago, and I thought, well, you know, maybe if I get an interview, I can arrange it all at the same time. And funny thing, I got in. and moved to Chicago, where I hated the University of Chicago, but I learned to do things one day at a time, so I went to meetings and I wept. Every place I moved, you know, I had meetings. I had AA. I had the fellowship, no matter what happened. And there have been some other things that have happened in my sobriety that haven't been fun. My mother died. I lost a fortune. All sorts of weird things happened that were devastating at the time. But I didn't drink. I went to meetings. I showed up. I did what I was told. And so I did the internship a day at a time and was fortunate enough because of the fellowship in Chicago to recognize that I loved Chicago and was able to stay. And now I have, every day I don't believe this, I have a job that it's as if it was written for me. I have the best job in the world. It's for a lot of people, it would not be the best job in the world. I work with cancer patients every day. But for me, it's the perfect job. It's perfect. It's unbelievable. It's unreal that I was hired. It doesn't make any sense to me. Nobody my age gets hired at these kinds of jobs. It's just a fabulous everyday experience. And I know that I owe every minute of this to AA. I have a relationship that I... it was very hard getting into because, you know, I have my history. But I was determined when I was newly sober that I would at least spend some time with other lesbians who I wasn't interested in sexually. So I found a woman who was almost 20 years older than I am. Her politics are to the left of lavender. And she was politically active, and I was pretty sure she wouldn't want to spend 2 seconds with anybody, some little twit from the suburbs with pearls. And so so we practiced actually going out to dinner and coffee around meetings and talking. And she was living with someone at the time. And I was still dating everything in sight. And but we had a really good time together and came to actually know one another. What a concept. And then, you know, the inevitable happens. That little goodbye hug becomes a little more. Just after our first anniversary, we got sober at the same time. And we've been together ever since. So we've been together 16 years. And we have tested each other's sobriety. but we do with our relationships are not always easy, although ours after the first year has been easier than most. It's had its ups and downs at times, but we do it one day at a time. We learn not to make assumptions. We benefit from, although we don't attend, we benefit from the tenets of Al-Anon, and really have learned to deal with each other gently, the way that we learn to deal with ourselves in AA. And I'm incredibly grateful for that experience every day. I'm also very grateful that David and Lee brought me down here, and that Lee and Mark met us at the airport, which I haven't been to Houston sober ever. Ever. I would not be able to know where I was. And the hospitality here is just what I remember in Texas. I did live in Midland, Odessa for a little while, and obviously lived in Oklahoma for a little while. I'm very grateful that you guys met us at the airport, took us out for food, and fed us and let us nap. And this is a great roundup. I'm really glad that it's so well attended, and I'm so grateful to meet all you Texans. I'm glad to be back. Thank you very much for listening.